this time on your weekly constitutional.
The Equal Rights Amendment is one state short of the 38 states needed in order to become part of the Constitution. Virginia has an opportunity to be the 38th and final state needed in order to make the Equal Rights Amendment part of the Constitution. What does that mean as a practical matter for the Constitution under constitutional law? Is this even something that could work? And what would it look like if the Equal Rights Amendment were ratified?
That was Michelle Callan, the Deputy Solicitor General of the Commonwealth of Virginia, talking about an issue that's back in the news after a hiatus of several decades. The Equal Rights Amendment. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly constitutional, and this week, can Virginia save the ERA?
Welcome to your weekly constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
Amending the United States Constitution is a lengthy and arduous process that frequently lasts years or even decades. So it is with the proposed Equal Rights Amendment, which you may last have heard about back in the 70s or 80s. What's up with that? What's been going on all these years? And is it all about to come to a dramatic conclusion?
My name is Michelle Callan. I am currently working as Deputy Solicitor General for the Commonwealth of Virginia. And what that means is that our office focuses on constitutional matters involving the Commonwealth of Virginia. We focus on matters before the U.S. Supreme Court and then constitutional issues in the Virginia Supreme Court, the Fourth Circuit, and other higher profile constitutional issues that involve Virginia.
The only thing I know about solicitors general is that they reputedly wear morning coats to oral argument. Do you wear a morning coat to your oral arguments?
No.
Oh, I'm so disappointed.
As far as I know, state solicitors general have not typically done that. The Virginia Solicitor General position has not been around for that long. And my understanding is that even in the DOJ Solicitor General's office, a number of people, particularly the women, do not wear morning coats. It's a big thing among the female Supreme Court bar, those from the DOJ SG's office, in terms of whether or not they choose to wear their morning coats.
You could start a trend in Virginia. You know, Virginia is a very traditional state. You could institute a tradition. Just think about it. At any rate, that's a very important position within the Commonwealth of Virginia, and we're very pleased and proud to have you on the show with us. What are we going to talk about today?
We're going to talk about the Equal Rights Amendment.
Mm-hmm. Is the Commonwealth of Virginia officially now behind the ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment?
Hopefully the answer to that question will be yes by the end of the next legislative session. As of now, Virginia has yet to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment.
But what I'm asking is the governor behind it?
My understanding is he is.
Okay. So, I mean, otherwise you wouldn't be part of this, right?
Well, the attorney general is separate from the governor.
That's right. You get separately elected. That's right. Or your boss does.
Exactly.
Now, remind me, who is the current attorney general in the Commonwealth?
Mark Herring.
Of course, I think I actually met Mark at some point in the past. And so Mark is behind the ratification of the ERA.
He is. So he formally supported it during the last legislative session.
So since you work for Mark, you are now part of what? What exactly is your role in this ratification?
So part of what the Solicitor General's office does is we review various bills that arise as part of the Virginia legislative session. And our office specifically focuses on constitutional issues.
Mm-hmm.
So any constitutional, you know, effort to ratify a new constitutional amendment will come through the Solicitor General's office.
Very good. And so what exactly does that mean? Does that mean that you're advocating for it? Does it mean that you're simply researching the constitutional implications of it and preparing for a possible ratification? What exactly are you doing?
Depends on the particular matter. For Equal Rights Amendment, we are fully supportive of it. And so I've been also helping with various advocates who are looking into the constitutional issues. And so folks at VA Ratify ERA, we've been in touch about potential constitutional questions related to the Equal Rights Amendment and answering those questions. In my personal capacity, I'm also just passionate about this issue. So I'm actually working on organizing a law school convention for law students in October to learn more about the Equal Rights Amendment. But what's a more fun way to learn about the Constitution than actually play a role in potentially changing it?
I tell you what, it's one of the best exercises I've ever heard of. And you mentioned a group that you're working with called Virginia Ratify ERA. We've actually interviewed, I believe, the founder of that group. Her name is Katie Hornung. And she was in an episode about within the last year. And we talked all about her efforts, and I'll simply reference people to our podcast hosting site if you want to visit us at Podomatic, ywc.podomatic.com, or simply Google us, Your Weekly Constitutional. You'll come up with the site and simply enter in the search bar the letters ERA, and you'll come up with that previous episode. But give us a brief overview of the situation for those who didn't have the benefit of listening to that previous episode. What exactly is going on here?
So in order to change the Constitution, there has to be the amendment process requires approval by two-thirds of the House and the Senate, and then ratification of the amendment. After that happens, ratification of the amendment by three-quarters of the states. Currently, given that we have 50 states, three-quarters of the states is 38 states. And as of today, 37 states have ratified the Equal Rights Amendment. This last legislative session in Virginia, there was a huge amount of support and advocacy.
Maybe I interrupt you, Michelle, but I want to preserve the suspense a little bit. let's go back in time. The ERA, or the Equal Rights Amendment, is unfamiliar to many people of the younger generation because it was really sort of a 1970s thing. Even though there had been many proposals over the years for something along these lines, it really started picking up momentum in the 1970s, and Congress actually passed the version of the ERA that we're still talking about. Was it in the early 70s or was it late 60s?
Early 70s.
And that was by the necessary two-thirds majority in both houses of Congress, as set out in Article 5 of the Constitution. But that's only part one of the two-stage process, and then part two, as you mentioned, is ratification by three-quarters of the legislatures of the states. And you got very close, but there are some complicating factors as well. What are those complicating factors in the way that this thing was originally proposed?
So the way it was originally proposed is that there was a deadline that was added to the preamble of the Equal Rights Amendment. So the Equal Rights Amendment is in three parts. The first part, which is the part that people are more familiar with, just says equality of rights under the law should not be denied or abridged by a state or the United States on account of sex. The second clause of the amendment itself sets forth a two-year period before it actually takes effect. And then the third clause gives the power to Congress to enact the legislation to protect the Equal Rights Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
In the preamble, the kind of writing that Congress puts forth to introduce the amendment itself, there's a deadline that was put in. Initially, the deadline set forth 7 years and then was thereafter extended for three additional years. But even though that extended deadline of three additional years expired in 1983.
Has any other proposed constitutional amendment been subjected to such a deadline?
There have been deadlines in prior constitutional amendments. It became a trend in the 20th century to start adding deadlines, but those deadlines were included in the actual language of the amendment themselves. And there has been constitutional amendments that have thereafter been added to the Constitution with the deadline. There became a trend around the time of the ERA to remove the deadline from the actual language because the thought was that it cluttered the Constitution. And there was also a thought as to whether the deadline is something that applies specifically to states or something that applies to Congress. And so the deadlines in other amendments, proposed amendments like the Equal Rights Amendment, were put in the preamble, not in the text of the amendment itself.
That's an interesting point. Yeah, if you actually put it in the amendment and it gets ratified, all of a sudden you've got, you know, 5 or 10 or whatever your deadlines as part of your basic law, which it really is not any relevant once the ratification takes place. So I can see putting in the preamble. I guess my point is that this is not really always done or hasn't always been done. And perhaps the most famous example is one of the original proposed 12 amendments to the Constitution, which was, I believe it was originally the second that was proposed by Congress and sent to the states for ratification. It didn't make it. And it was resurrected 200 years later and became our 27th Amendment. So literally you had something that was, you know, written by James Madison, passed by the first Congress, sent out to the states, and this simply was out there in the ether for all those years. And then finally, I think the story goes that it was a young lawyer or a law student who noticed this and started a campaign to get it ratified. And by golly, he eventually did it. And I guess it's just a matter of tying off loose ends, isn't it? If you want to talk about a basic justification for putting it in a deadline, I mean, we might not want these things just hanging out there all those years.
Yeah, and so that's one of the questions. What's fascinating about the 27th Amendment is it undercuts some of the case law that argues about amendments needing to be contemporaneous, need to be within a certain period of time. As a starting point, there really isn't much law either way about the ratification process. Mm-hmm. And so us lawyers, constitutional lawyers, have very little to work off of. But there is some case law out there that says that an amendment needs to be somewhat contemporaneous. But if the 27th Amendment took 203 years to ratify, it's hard to argue that the Equal Rights Amendment, if there is a 38th state that ratifies, ideally Virginia, that taking from the 1970s until that point, that is improper. That seriously undercuts the propriety of the 27th Amendment.
Yeah, that's an interesting comparison. I mean, I guess I can see reasons for wanting more or less contemporaneous ratification. I guess the idea is that, you know, amendments are from certain places and certain times. And, you know, if you've got an open-ended deadline and a static goal, or I guess it's not that static of 3/4 of the states if you keep adding new states to the union. But it sort of prolongs it. It, you know, it does a ratification that took place in, you know, 1797, you know, equal a ratification that takes place in 1992. I guess there are questions there. And there are arguments in favor of having time limits, but the 27th Amendment sort of stands in opposition to all of that. I mean, if it was good enough for Madison, you know, why isn't it good enough for the proponents of the ERA?
Exactly. And I think that also gets to issues that were raised even during the legislative history for the Equal Rights Amendment back in the 1970s. Part of the issue with the deadlines also is a question of who the deadline directs. So the states, when they actually ratify the amendment itself, they're not ratifying the deadline. And so to the extent the deadline is something that is ultimately enforceable, and that's even unclear because Article 5, which is the provision of the Constitution that sets forth the process of amending the Constitution, makes no reference to deadlines. So then the question is, this deadline and this preamble, what does it actually mean? And one of the most consistent readings of that is that is language that Congress imposes essentially on itself. It's well established that a Congress can't bind a future Congress. And so currently there are efforts in Congress, both in the Senate and in the House, to remove the deadline from the Equal Rights Amendment. And there's likely to be debate as to whether or not the deadline is even enforceable to begin with, but then to the extent it is, and then it's removed, whether that's proper. And there's this overarching theory of constitutional law to separate out the political process from the judicial process and to view the constitutional amendment process as something that's inherently political in nature. So if Congress wants to impose a deadline on itself, the argument would be that it can and judges can't review it. And then the contrast of that is that if Congress wants to remove its own deadline, it has the ability to do that as well.
That's a really interesting argument. So it's really not inherently part of the ratification process of ERA. It is simply an add-on and done in the preamble, and arguably it is extra constitutional to begin with. You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week I'm speaking with Michelle Callan, the Deputy Solicitor General of the Commonwealth of Virginia, all about the ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment. It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Michelle Callan, who's the Deputy Solicitor General of Virginia. And we're talking because the ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment, may very well be ratified by the Commonwealth in the very near future. Before the break, we were discussing the legislative deadlines that were imposed upon the ERA, upon its ratification, something that's not mentioned in Article 5 of the Constitution, and whether that might prevent it from being ratified now, decades later. Michelle explained to me why she believes that those deadlines do not prevent Virginia from ratifying now. I'm sure you've thought of this argument, but I'm reminded of a seemingly unrelated case of Clinton versus New York. And that involved a line item veto. That was an attempt to impose fiscal responsibility on our profligate national government. And the idea was that the president would be able to look at a statute, an appropriations bill, once it had been passed, and to go through, or act by the Congress, and to go through and not just veto the entire bill, but to go through and strike out particular items he didn't like. And with the idea that he could get down at least closer to having a balanced budget. The problem with that is, of course, it's an enormous amount of power to give to the president. And more fundamentally, it alters what the Supreme Court later called the finely wrought procedures set out in the Constitution for appropriations of money. I wonder if the same argument could be brought to bear here, that Article 5 sets out some very specific requirements. There are a couple of ways to amend the Constitution. We've always done it the same way, but you can also do it with state conventions and that sort of thing. And they were very explicit about how they wanted it done, and they didn't mention any darn deadlines.
Exactly. And there's a canon of statutory construction and kind of has one of the ideas of how lawyers interpret language in legislative texts and in the Constitution. It's called expressio unus, and it's the idea that expressing one item of an associated group excludes others that are left unmentioned.
Yeah.
And so here it's the idea that consent ratification is part of the language of the Fifth Amendment, but withdrawal of consent, rescission, or a deadline are not something that's kind of set forth in there. And so the idea is, look, if the framers actually wanted to allow for something like a deadline or something I suspect we'll talk about soon, or rescission as well, those are things that would naturally go together with the language that currently exists in the amendment. And so the fact that it exists in Article 5, and the fact that it's not there doesn't really accord the ability to kind of do these extra constitutional restrictions.
Yeah, they've already established the procedures, and to paraphrase a common expression, you can't just make stuff up and add it on. In fact, I'm thinking of yet another seemingly unrelated idea, but you recall, of course, the brouhaha a couple of decades ago about term limits. Some states tried to impose limits on their own representatives in Congress, or I think maybe even their senators. And, you know, for the most part, states do control elections. And, you know, there was an argument that they could do that. But ultimately, the Supreme Court of the United States said no, at least with regard to federal offices. The Constitution sets out the terms of office, and you can't limit that. You can't change that at a state level. So again, the same argument with your fancy Latin terminology, I guess they teach you something there in the Solicitor General's office, means that if it ain't there, it ain't there. You mentioned the R word, rescission. That is another issue that plagues and, in fact, arguably changes the count of the ratifying states. What are you talking about?
To make matters for the ERA even more complicated, over the course of between 1977 and 1979, five states that ratified the Equal Rights Amendment purported to rescind, and that's Idaho, Kentucky, Nebraska, Tennessee, and South Dakota. Interesting tidbit about Kentucky's is that the legislature voted to rescind, but their female governor vetoed the rescission. So query whether Kentucky's rescission is even a rescission.
That's an interesting question, because the chief executive of the state, the governors, don't typically get involved in ratification, do they?
I think it depends on the particular state procedure, but that's another question that in, from a federal law perspective, what role that they may or may not have that has not been decided by federal courts.
Oh, my. It gets curiouser and curiouser. So if all of the states that have purported to rescind are deducted, where does that put your count?
Five states less. So
you're very much against that rescission argument then?
Well, I think as a legal matter, it's just something that hasn't yet been decided. There have been rescissions that have occurred in the past. And so, for example, with regard to the 14th Amendment, both Ohio and New Jersey attempted to rescind ratification. With the 15th Amendment, New York purported to rescind ratification. But both of those rescissions became moot over the course of the constitutional amendment process, such that there ended up being enough states eventually to be able to say that they've got the necessary number of states. So the question of whether or not a rescission is proper or not has not been decided as a matter of law. There are some good reasons, though, why treating a rescission differently than a ratification, why that should be treated differently.
Tell me.
So one of them is just looking at the framers' intent. James Madison wrote that the Constitution requires an adoption in toto and forever. And so the idea that you can ratify and then change your mind is inconsistent with that language from James Madison. There's also the idea, and this was expressed during the legislative history during the ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment, Representative Edwards said that allowing for rescission would make every state house in the nation a battleground at every session, because it meant that all proposed constitutional amendments would be subject to constant rescission efforts. And so the idea of the finality associated with the Constitution is undercut once rescission enters the picture.
That's an interesting and very practical argument. I'm reminded of yet another seemingly unrelated debate. I'm sure you recall that after the Civil War, the question came before the Supreme Court as to whether secession was constitutional. And though it might seem a little bit after the fact and irrelevant because it had already been determined in the seminal case of Lee versus Grant, the court decided that no, that joining the Union was a one-way, one-time decision. And once you had joined, you're in forever. And I suppose the same sort of logic could then apply. Maybe that's exactly what Madison meant, is that once you have agreed to change the basic law, that's it. You don't go back.
Exactly.
Yeah, in fact, you could even make an argument sort of a fairness. If one legislature of one state in year one ratified, and other states are moving forward with ratification, and you're getting near the threshold, and then there's a change in politics in that original state that ratified, they can undercut the whole ratification process by then rescinding.
Exactly.
Very, very interesting. And of course, if there is rescission, it would be doubly tragic for your cause, because not only would it make ratification more difficult, but Virginia would lose the honor of being the last necessary state.
That would likely be the case if we were to ratify next legislative session.
And of course, that's extremely important as well. I don't think Virginia's ever gotten over the fact that it was Tennessee and not Virginia that was the one that actually passed the 19th Amendment.
Well, from my recollection, Virginia didn't ratify the 19th Amendment until the 1950s. So I don't know that we were in close competition with Tennessee there at the time.
All righty then. Well, this is all fascinating, and we've gotten down into some of the constitutional weeds. Are there any other constitutional or strictly legal issues that you've been looking at in your capacity there as the Deputy Solicitor General of Virginia?
That is a good question. I mean, I think that the main legal questions really are the meaning of the rescission and the meaning of the deadline. I think those are kind of the two overarching questions that there really isn't a formal constitutional answer in terms of case law that exists out there. There are a couple cases that are relevant, but there's one from the 1920s and other very old cases. And so this is just new constitutional ground. And so from a practical standpoint, as a constitutional lawyer and who practices before various courts, but including the U.S. Supreme Court, really this is the sort of thing that ultimately comes down to the Supreme Court and the justices who are on the Supreme Court right now. And so these are really questions that legal prognosticators and constitutional lawyers will be guessing to see what this U.S. Supreme Court is going to make of some of these issues if they were to come up over the course of litigation.
And the most likely way they would come up is if you are actually successful. So let's bring it up to the current day. We know that by a single vote, Virginia did not ratify during its last legislative session. But you all are not giving up. And so what's happening now?
So there's an election coming up in November, and I understand that the advocates on the ground are emphasizing this as an important issue for the election. And I mean, I think part of the arguments that VA Ratify ERA and other ERA advocates raise is that this isn't strictly a partisan issue, and it's something that has bipartisan support. So the hope is that the folks who are elected, doesn't matter whether they're Republican or Democrat, to the advocates, it matters that they support the Equal Rights Amendment. And it has received bipartisan support in the past. In fact, the sponsors has had in the Virginia legislature has had Republican sponsors and Democratic sponsors for the ratification here in the legislature. And so I think there's a groundswell now of bringing this to folks' attention, with the hope that with this next legislative session, there will be a majority willing to vote to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment.
Well, pretend that I am a skeptical legislator. I'm the very last guy you need, okay? And I emphasize the word guy. So here I'm, this old, crusty white guy, and I'm looking at you skeptically, and I look at you and I say, why is it important to ratify the ERA now? I mean, after all, back in the 70s, the Supreme Court applied what we already have in the Constitution, the Equal Protection Clause. It applied it to women. And so really, I mean, we've got constitutional equality for women already. So why are you wasting my time with us?
One thing to note and to keep in mind is a lot of the advocacy on the other side against the ERA, and a reason why it failed was not because of men necessarily. There was actually a large number of women who opposed the Equal Rights Amendment in the 1970s. But even positing the hypothetical as you presented,
I'm pretty old and crusty.
So I think there are two, from a constitutional standpoint, there are two things to think about. The first is how the 14th Amendment jurisprudence applies to gender, and I'll explain that. And then the second is where we are headed in terms of interpretation of laws, and whether or not this interpretation and understanding of the 14th Amendment is something that is likely to remain with some of the new perspective of judges on the bench.
Right. And I'll just interject that the 14th Amendment, specifically Section 1, is where the Equal Protection Clause is. Okay, so that's what we're talking about.
Exactly. And so in the 1970s, in large part to Justice Ginsburg's advocacy, the Equal Protection Clause being understood to apply to gender discrimination, in large part that area of law was developed thanks to Justice Ginsburg back when she was an advocate. And so she really was one of the main advocates who argued that the Equal Protection Clause protects not only race discrimination, but also protects against gender discrimination.
Wasn't there just a movie made about that?
There were two.
Yeah, tell me, what are their titles? I'm ashamed to say I haven't seen either one of them yet. I mean to.
So the first one is Because of Sex, and that's one that has various actors playing there's someone playing Justice Ginsburg, and it's a typical Hollywood movie. And then there's a documentary called RBG.
Right.
And that one, that's my personal favorite between the two, but it talks about Justice Ginsburg's life, her advocacy, and how she got to where she is.
Okay. So she's back in the 70s advocating to apply the Equal Protection Clause to women. Please continue.
And this is at the same time of the groundswell in support of the Equal Rights Amendment, which interestingly actually played a role in some of her advocacy. So she advocated for the same level of scrutiny, the same level of judicial skepticism to apply to gender discrimination that applies to race discrimination. In the context of race discrimination, the law applies what's called strict scrutiny. And the idea is that there has to be a compelling government interest that's narrowly tailored. And basically the idea of that is that it's very, very hard to discriminate based off race. For gender discrimination, the way that the law evolved, and this is contrary to Justice Ginsburg's advocacy, is there was a different level of scrutiny. that evolved to apply to gender discrimination. And that's called intermediate scrutiny, meaning the government only needs a substantially, an important governmental interest that's substantially related to the law at issue.
Okay, I have to put on my law professor hat here and orient people who might not be familiar with this. There are three levels of scrutiny, arguably four now that we have gay rights, but I'll try to keep it as straightforward as I can. Generally speaking, if I go into court and I argue that something's unconstitutional, if I say, you're discriminating against me because I'm short, well, too bad, so sad. I mean, the government has to satisfy only something called rational basis scrutiny. It simply has to say, well, we're discriminating against Harris. Here's our rational reason for it, and we have a legitimate purpose, and it's rationally related. Our regulation is rationally related to that purpose. Perhaps a better example is, let's say I were blind, and the government says I can't have a driver's license. Well, that's a very legitimate purpose, isn't it? Traffic safety. And restricting me from driving is rationally related to that. So I'm going to lose most of the time on most constitutional claims because the Constitution doesn't answer every question. On the other end of the spectrum, if the government's discriminating against me because of the color of my skin, well, that's racial discrimination. And the government will likely lose because, as you pointed out, there's really no reason to discriminate against me because I'm white. There just isn't. And there certainly is no compelling reason to do so. And so therefore, the government's almost always going to lose. And as you just explained, there's a middle level in there called intermediate scrutiny that does not give, it gives more protection than the lowest level, rational basis scrutiny, but not nearly as much protection as the highest level, strict scrutiny. And it's what my friend, I'm paraphrasing here, Wanda Sobieski, who knows more about women's rights than anybody I know, she refers to as pretend constitutional rights or little constitutional rights. And that was a big issue and remains a big issue for a lot of feminists, doesn't it?
It does. And Justice Ginsburg was advocating for strict scrutiny mm-hmm. for gender-based discrimination, the idea that when the government discriminates based on gender, that should be treated on the same level as discrimination based on sex. And she was one vote away in the Supreme Court from getting there. And the ERA was actually a reason why she didn't get there. So there's a case called Frontiero versus Richardson that Justice Ginsburg argued, and she got four justices to agree that strict scrutiny should apply to gender-based discrimination. Justice Powell, however, ultimately agreed with the result in the case, meaning he concurred in the opinion, but he did not accept the strict scrutiny to be applied to gender-based discrimination. And his reasoning for that was he wanted to defer applying strict scrutiny because at that time, this was in 1973, the Equal Rights Amendment had momentum that would allow the democratic process to provide heightened scrutiny. And for that reason, he didn't vote along to get strict scrutiny, and the law eventually evolved to create this level of intermediate scrutiny. So
that's a very interesting reason for not going along with strict scrutiny. He was basically saying, look, we can change the Constitution through interpretation, as the court sometimes does, but wouldn't it be better if we went through the ratification process and therefore the people themselves would change their basic law?
Exactly. And the thought process for that is that the Equal Rights Amendment would provide strict scrutiny. As the law evolved, without the Equal Rights Amendment, there's intermediate scrutiny. And so the law hasn't evolved to do, as a kind of legal matter, exactly what the Equal Rights Amendment would do, which is apply strict scrutiny. So the 14th Amendment doesn't do everything as a legal matter of what the Equal Rights Amendment would do.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm in the midst of a wonderful discussion with Michelle Callan, the Deputy Solicitor General of Virginia, all about the possibility right around the corner that the Commonwealth of Virginia may be the last necessary state to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. And now it's time to finish our discussion with Michelle Callan, who's telling us that her home state of Virginia may be the last necessary one to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. Now, you might think the Equal Rights Amendment is superfluous at this point, since the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment does protect women to some degree. But Michelle was explaining to me that that protection is not as great as it would be if ERA were ratified. Well, let's just think about this again in the most basic way possible. It's almost impossible for the government to get away with racial discrimination. What's your compelling reason, government, for discriminating against somebody because he or she's black or Latino or whatever? And even if you've got a compelling reason, is this the least restrictive way for you to achieve that? Is it really narrowly tailored, your regulation? It's going to fail one of those two prongs, as we say, of strict scrutiny. So in some sense, intermediate scrutiny allows the government to discriminate against women in ways that it could not discriminate against a person on the basis of race. Let me play devil's advocate again. Aren't there some real differences between men and women that should be taken into account? Shouldn't the government be able to differentiate between women and men? And isn't it therefore justified to have a lower level of scrutiny?
So in some ways, that might kind of be double dipping, constitutional double dipping. And the reason for that is that if there are laws that are accounting for actual differences between men and women, so pregnancy and childbirth, for example, then applying strict scrutiny, those laws could survive, in theory, strict scrutiny if they actually are narrowly tailored to a compelling governmental interest. And so whereas there are less differences that you can think of that would have a legitimate basis to distinguish on the basis of race, that might exist in the context of differences between men and women, such as, for example, childbirth.
Yeah, try as I might, I'm never going to do that one. Your point is, then, that strict scrutiny would have accommodated any real differences that really justified differential treatment by the government.
Exactly. And so if the Equal Rights Amendment were ratified and strict scrutiny applied, or if the 14th Amendment law evolved in a way to apply strict scrutiny, differences between men and women could be accounted for through application of strict scrutiny.
One huge issue back in the 70s, when we were just starting to allow women some degree of equality in the military, was the issue of the draft. Now, the draft had existed all the way through Vietnam. I think it ended in 75 or thereabouts, and we've had since then the all-volunteer force. But we still have the Selective Service Act. I and other young men for decades now have had to register for the draft, and at least we're subject to being called up if a draft is reinstituted. But to this day, women are not subject to that requirement. There is discrimination arguably in favor of women in that regard, but nonetheless, gender discrimination. And by the way, we should point out that it's really not appropriate to say that the Equal Protection Clause only protects women. It protects anybody from being discriminated against on the basis of gender. And there have actually been at least one case filed that went, I think, all the way to the Supreme Court where a young man challenged that differentiation and was rebuffed. And he was rebuffed, and the draft, the gender discrimination inherent in the Selective Service Act was upheld because at least back in the day, and this was right around 1980, I think, the military said, there are differences, and we just don't need women the way we need men. How do you respond to that kind of argumentation today?
Well, one thing that's important to keep in mind is I think it was October 2017 that the Pentagon actually recommended that women be required to serve in selective service. And so to the extent there's this concern that women will be included in the selective service or part of the draft, I mean, there's already movement to that effect even without the Equal Rights Amendment. Back in the day, women weren't allowed to be part of, have all kinds of roles in the military that they're allowed to have today and that they excel at. And so the idea today is that to the extent that there are physical differences between men and women, those will play out. And if there's a, I'm not very familiar with the process of competing for these roles, but presumably if there's a piece that involves running or lifting or, physical differences, those can be accounted for by just allowing the women to participate in those efforts. And if they make it, that's great. And if they don't, then they don't. But there isn't a need to actually discriminate on the basis of gender in order to draw those lines.
Yeah. I think that's one of those arguments that, as you point out, strict scrutiny could still have accommodated legitimate differences between men and women. And moreover, history seems to have bypassed this argument because, of course, we now know that women can serve, I think, in every single role that men can. That, as you say, they may very well be included in selective service in the future. I recently saw a campaign advertisement for a woman, I forget her name, who is challenging Senator Mitch McConnell in Kentucky. And she describes herself as a former Marine combat pilot. So I think that horse done left the barn in that particular case. Okay, so you've address the issue of why this is important. You're arguing this now in the state of Virginia. What's the next step for the proponents of ERA in VA in Virginia?
So I actually wanted to go back, if we could take a minute, because there was one other reason why the 14th Amendment the way it's been interpreted, isn't kind of set in the way that one would think it is. And that's important to keep in mind now when folks are deciding whether or not the Equal Rights Amendment would even do anything today. And that's because of the judicial philosophy of a lot of judges that have been joining the bench recently. Mm-hmm. And Justice Scalia pointed this out really well. Justice Scalia adhered to a theory of constitutional interpretation called originalism. And it was this idea that the Constitution or laws should be interpreted based on the original understanding of the authors at the time that the law was passed or that aspect of the Constitution came into being. So the 14th Amendment, at the time that it was ratified, it was a given that it didn't apply to women. That was actually a reason why a lot of the suffragettes did not actually support that group of amendments. And so originalists, people who adhere to this philosophy, would not actually believe that the 14th Amendment protects against gender discrimination. And Justice Scalia put it in a compelling way. He said, certainly the Constitution does not require discrimination on the basis of sex. The only issue is whether it prohibits it. It doesn't. And so one of the changes that's occurred in recent years for the judiciary is there has been a lot of support for this originalist understanding of the Constitution. And President Trump has advocated putting judges on the bench in the mold of Justice Scalia. And there's been a lot of support for this originalist perspective. And so to the extent we have more and more judges who are looking to interpret the Constitution in the way that the relevant amendments, actually the ratifiers of that amendment understood it to be, this understanding of the 14th Amendment to encompass gender discrimination is not really kind of good law from the perspective of originalists, if that makes sense.
It makes a great deal of sense. In layman's terms, the Federalist Society and most recently Mitch McConnell and the Senate and our current president have very effectively packed the federal judiciary with very conservative Republican appointees. And so support for even the limited protection of gender by the Equal Protection Clause may be eroding, and that protection may go away.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, now let's get to where we are currently. You guys are going to try again to get another vote in the General Assembly of Virginia. You're going to have, I think you were going to tell me before, there's some sort of convention for law students that's going to happen in Richmond. When's that going to happen?
That's going to be on October 26th.
October 26th. And is it just for law students or is it for other supporters of the ERA?
It's for supporters and skeptics of the ERA. It's geared primarily towards law students, mm-hmm. but there's space also for folks in the community to come and learn more about the amendment process, learn more about the deadline and all the things that we talked about today and the rescissions and what that would actually mean in terms of the constitutional amendment process, what the implications of the ERA might be in terms of interpreting that down the road.
Okay, so that's in Richmond. Where specifically in Richmond is it going to be held?
It will be at the University of Richmond.
University of Richmond. I'm guessing in some sort of auditorium or basketball court or something.
The moot court room.
In the moot court. Well, that's... I think you're probably going to fill that up unless it's a lot bigger than most moot courtrooms I've seen. So you have a bit of spillover there. And that, again, the date is?
October 26th.
Do you have a time?
It's going to be all day.
All day on October 26th at the University of Richmond. Just follow the crowd of feminists heading into the moot courtroom. Okay, and is there, what's the first important date in terms of votes? I mean, does the General Assembly have a particular date it's going to take a vote on?
So my understanding is that folks are optimistic that this will happen in January.
In January of this year. So the fall is going to be a fevered time. Well, I do note that even though I'm sure you were disappointed at your one vote failure last time, that ratifying it in 2020 will have a certain resonance, won't it? It'll be exactly almost 100 years since the ratification of women's right to vote at all.
Exactly. The 19th Amendment was passed in 1920. Which is confusing given the numbers, but
I always get irritated by that. Why wasn't it the 20th Amendment? That would have been so much better. Or why didn't they ratify it in 1919? That would have made it so much easier to remember. Okay, but let's talk about exactly what happens next. We've got just a couple minutes left. If in fact Virginia does ratify, does it just automatically everybody agree that it's part of the Constitution? What happens to it?
So I think that would be up to the archivist of the United States. So once Virginia ratifies, and if folks kind of agree that the three-state strategy, that getting three more states is sufficient, then it's up to the archivist of the United States to decide whether or not it goes into the Constitution. If the archivist puts it in the Constitution, then presumably somebody will sue to try to say that that's improper. And if the archivist refuses to put it in the Constitution, then advocates in favor of the Equal Rights Amendment may sue in order to say that it should be in the Constitution.
Michelle, who the heck is the archivist of the United States? I mean, has anyone ever heard of this person, whoever he or she is?
Well, my understanding is the archivist's role tends to be not particularly controversial, typically, and kind of oversees just the Constitution generally.
If you are successful, Michelle, you are going to put whoever this person is in hot water. So I hope you realize what you're doing to this poor person. All right. And then, so then there'll be a lawsuit, obviously, and probably something that goes to the Supreme Court. Well, I think we're just about out of time, but Michelle Callan, Deputy Solicitor General of the Great Commonwealth of Virginia, thanks very much for explaining all this to us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's that happy, happy, happy time. It's time for a quiz. With the quiz queen, Mary Furlong Minkoff, who so enjoys posing tough questions and then diabolically laughing when people miss. See? I told you, didn't I?
Quite diabolical, yes.
Well, and we have to give credit. That's Kendall. Kendall gave the drafted these. She's our engineer. She's running the board.
She's the brains behind the regalness that I bring to
I see.
The quiz.
Okay, absolutely. I understand we have somebody named Pete on the line.
Yes, indeed, Professor, and great to hear you live here, Mary.
Thank you.
Tremendous. Where are you from, Pete?
Well, right now in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Knoxville, Tennessee.
Knoxville.
What a great town.
Yes, yes, yes it is. Thank you, Professor.
I love Knoxville, Tennessee. In fact, I love it so much that I live there. All
yes.
Right. So, Mary, you got a question for Pete?
I do. Are you ready, Pete?
I am ready, Mary.
All right. If a state denies its citizens the right to vote, how can they be punished? A, by charging a fine. B, reducing the number of representatives for that state. C, reducing the number of senators for that state. Or D, no punishment is allowed.
Oh, my. So if a state...
Yes.
Just think about it. This is definitely one you can figure out, Pete.
Okay, good. Thanks,
even if you're not familiar with the provision. Think about it. Read the question again, please, Mary.
Yes, please.
If a state denies its citizens the right to vote, how can the state be punished? A, by charging the state a fine. B, by reducing the number of representatives the state has. C, by reducing the number of senators the state has. Or D, no punishment is allowed.
Wow. Well, I don't like, should I talk?
Sure. Like, talk to your analysis.
Okay, yes, okay. So I have a problem with B and C because I don't think you could reduce the representatives or the senators because that's set by the Constitution based on, well, for senators, of course, two per state.
Right.
And so that knocked out C. And then for B, I think we can knock out B because that'd be proportional based on the population anyway.
Well, let me add something to your analysis that may not have been apparent. This we're actually talking about a provision in the Constitution.
Okay.
So the fact that the Constitution in one place sets the number of senators or representatives is something that, of course, can be changed by an amendment.
Okay.
So you see what I'm saying? I mean, I wouldn't knock those out on that basis because what we're talking about is a constitutional provision here, a constitutional punishment, if you will, for denying people the right to vote.
Okay. Wow. Okay. I've listened to all your podcasts for this class, and I can say people do a very good job going through the questions.
Uh-huh.
In general, methodically.
Right.
I would love to get the T-shirt, but I have to buy one if I don't win it.
Well, let's just go through them. Have you ever heard of a state paying the federal government a fine?
Yeah. No, I just heard the state not getting money, like in the Dole case up there in South Dakota.
Okay, right. So the states can be denied money if or federal grants if they don't comply with things like drinking age. Okay, that's understandable.
Okay.
Let me ask you this. Of these four choices, which one seems to be directly tied to the purpose of voting?
Directly tied to the purpose of voting? Maybe. Whoa. Well, D is nothing happens, right?
Correct.
Is that right, Mary?
Yes, D is no punishment.
Okay, no punishment. So we probably shouldn't say D. Why don't we say, I guess, the way you asked that question, Professor, maybe B, something to do with the representatives.
Now, why representatives rather than senators?
Well, senators, I would say, and forgive me, because I've taken con law, not by you, of course, but but I've taken con law, and you do a great job with First Amendment. So I would have to say the senators are fixed 2 per state, so that seems to be less squishy than the representatives.
Mary?
You are correct.
Pete, I told you. I told you you could figure this one out.
Yeah. Wow, Professor, you helped me, though, because...
Well, I just wanted to clarify.
But the pressure's on when you do the questions. I'm standing in the closet.
Well, we have very good sound quality there in your closet.
Oh, thank you, Professor, and thank you, Mary, so much.
All right. Well, thank you, Pete.
Thank you, Pete.
And I appreciate this guidance.
What is your tagline? You're the quiz queen. You've got a great tagline, and you keep forgetting to use it.
Well, Pete, it's the Constitution. Can you dig it?
I can dig it.
Dolly Madison garnered a reputation not only as a hostess and socialite, but also as a strategic political partner for her husband, a role that women of the time seldom fulfilled. This role did not come without controversy, as the male-dominated political realm was not always happy with Dolly's influence. Dolly's longtime friendship with Washington gossip columnist Margaret Bayard Smith provided her a tool to defend her own reputation and that of her husband's, and to take jabs at their political opponents. Dolly Madison often acted as a surrogate in her husband's absence. In one instance, when James Madison could not physically reach out to Senator Henry Clay, Dolly offered to dip snuff with him, thereby maintaining James's partnership with the Warhawk senator. This is Tyler Stanley with your Madison Minute.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Michelle Callan, the Deputy Solicitor General of the Commonwealth of Virginia, who shared with us her analysis of what's up with the ERA in VA. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. They got a new album out. Check it out on Spotify. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.